From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with actor Clint Eastwood. From Rawhide to Dirty Harry to producing films about jazz greats Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk, Eastwood's career has spanned over four decades. This Sunday, he receives a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild. Also, the gadget-rich film for kids, Spy Kids 2, is now out on video. We hear from filmmaker Robert Rodriguez. He also made the original Spy Kids. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Tears of the Sun, starring Bruce Willis. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Sam Litzinger. France has flatly rejected a proposal to give Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein a deadline of March 17th to fully cooperate with UN disarmament demands. Speaking through an interpreter, the French foreign minister said his country isn't ready to follow what he calls the logic of war.
We believe that the use of force can arouse resentment and hatred, fuel a clash of identities and of cultures, something that our generation has a prime responsibility to avoid.
The French official said he wants to give peace a chance, a comment that drew applause from many in the UN Security Council gallery. But Secretary of State Colin Powell told delegates the Iraqis have done nothing but try to delay disarmament and divide the Security Council.
We see when they're up against the wall, when they know there's going to be another ministerial-level meeting at the Security Council, suddenly some more action is taken. Only when they see this kind of pressure and they're afraid that the Security Council might act a united way do they step forward and take additional steps to make the inspectors believe, make us believe that they're really in compliance when they really aren't.
The vote on Iraq is planned for next week, even though the U.S. says it doesn't need another resolution before taking military action. Israeli officials say two Palestinian gunmen dressed as seminary students entered the home of a family in a Jewish settlement in the West Bank and opened fire, killing at least two and wounding six before being shot to death themselves. The military wing of the Palestinian group Hamas is claiming responsibility and promises more such attacks. The Congressional Budget Office has released its analysis of the president's budget, estimating federal deficit spending will reach nearly $2 trillion over the next decade. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The budget forecast is dreary. The CBO's new director, Douglas Holtz Aiken, was appointed by congressional Republicans and recruited from President Bush's Council of Economic Advisers. Under his direction, the CBO announced today that President Bush's proposed tax cuts and spending plans would run this year's federal budget $287 billion in the red. Next year's deficit would be worse, reaching $338 billion. After that, the deficits would gradually shrink, though the budget would not return to balance anytime soon. The new CBO estimates include President Bush's new proposed tax cuts worth about $1.5 trillion. Congressional Democrats and some moderate Republicans have vowed to stop those tax cuts from becoming law. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 66 points to 7,740. For the week, the Dow fell 151 points, though. The Nasdaq closed up 2 points to 1305. The S&P 500 index closed up nearly 7 points at 828. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Former Texas Attorney General Dan Morales has surrendered on mail fraud and conspiracy charges. From Austin, Janet Heimlich reports.
Dan Morales was released on personal recognizance after he agreed to give up his passport and remain in the country. He was indicted on charges stemming from business dealings when he won Texas's $17 billion tobacco settlement in 1998. Both Morales and his friend Mark Murr are accused of trying to pay Murr money he didn't deserve. Murr asked for $520 million for his role as an advisor on the case, but other attorneys complained he did little work. After his release, Morales declared, "Every single allegation of wrongdoing included in this indictment is false." But U.S. Attorney Johnny Sutton said the former attorney general abused the public trust. Morales is also accused of contracting to buy a $700,000 house using campaign funds. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
Military officials say the Navy has grounded its test fleet of V-22 Osprey aircraft for about 2 weeks so workers can replace potentially faulty hydraulic lines. They're said to be failing much more quickly than they should. The grounding comes at a critical time for the $40 billion program, which has been plagued by safety problems and faces a crucial hearing in May before a Pentagon panel. Many of the lights are going out on Broadway tonight. Actors and stagehands have voted to honor picket lines set up by the Musicians Union. Producers had said they would try to keep some shows open by using pre-recorded or electronic music, but there's no word all musicals have been shut down. The main sticking point, the question of how many musicians are required for each show. I'm Sam Litzinger, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR online shop features a variety of merchandise, including the new series of music compilations, I Heard It on NPR, on the NPR website, npr.org.
It's Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
Keep movin', movin', movin'. Oh, they're disapprovin'. Keep them doggies movin' broad. Don't try to...
It's been 40 years since Clint Eastwood herded cattle on the TV Western Rawhide. This Sunday, he receives a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild. Today, we'd like to honor him in our own way. After his turn on Rawhide, Eastwood teamed up with Italian director Sergio Leone for the spaghetti westerns A Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. These films began his transformation from actor to icon.
Listen, stranger, didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
See, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you men fired those shots at his feet. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize... I don't think it's nice you laughing. See, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
After Eastwood reworked the Western genre, he revitalized cop movies with his Dirty Harry series.
I know what you're thinking, punk. You're thinking, did he fire six shots or only five? Now, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and will blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself questions. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Following years as an action hero, blowing people away on screen, Clint Eastwood directed and starred in the movie Unforgiven, which reflected on the cost of violence.
It's a hell of a thing, killing a man. You take away all he's got, and all he's ever gonna.
Clint Eastwood's latest film, Bloodwork, is now out on DVD. He's currently working on an adaptation of the Dennis Lehane novel, Mystic River. Terry spoke to Eastwood in 1996, following the publication of his biography, which was written by Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel.
Many of the roles you've played have been, you know, men who are very strong, but men of few words. And it's ironic that your screen test for Rawhide was a long monologue that you were really uncomfortable with because you were having trouble at the time just remembering all of the words in this long monologue, and you didn't think of that as your strength as an actor. What do you think came through about you, even though you missed some of the words in the monologue?
Well, it was amusing because they told me it was going to be an interview test, and I'd done interview tests before.
This is where you just talk with the director?
Exactly. You just talk with the director, and I dislike those intensely because sometimes they ask you, what's your name? Why did you do this? It's a quick interview, usually by somebody who doesn't know how to do interviews, and you sit there on film and look sort of drop-jawed. But this was a test where they said, here, would you like, how are you at learning lines? I said, pretty good. And the guy said, here, well, here's a whole page of dialogue. I said, could you be ready to do this in a half hour? And so I thought, well, I'd just take the different beats and play those, and the different changes in the scene, kind of play those up and see how it would go, and just use my own words. The director happened to be the writer in that case, and he liked every word that he had written, so he was a little bit taken back. But it worked out all right in the end, because the people who viewed it and made the final decision didn't know the dialogue and could care less. They just wanted to see a look and a certain expression.
Why do you think you've gravitated to parts that are parts of few words? Is it that you don't like to remember or learn lines, or is it a sensibility thing that you gravitate more
to? No, it's just a sensibility thing. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of Fistful of Dollars, a first feature film I played in...
With Sergio Leone,
that I thought that the character would be much more interesting the less he spoke, the less you knew about him. I thought it would be, he'd be a more interesting character. And that often happens when you're doing a character in a play, that the person who talks the most, after a while, you get tired of... hearing the conversation, you want to know what's inside. Sometimes a silent moment, you can set up more of an effect than you can by just rambling on reams of dialogue. But later on, it's changed. My last picture, they couldn't shut me up.
Well, in some of your action roles, in some of your westerns and like Dirty Harry films, you not only don't say a lot, but what you do say, you're saying often through clenched teeth. in that really guttural voice. How did you develop that style of speaking?
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that the character just drives you in that. It's a character who is maybe frustrated with the things that the common person on the street are frustrated with, the bureaucracy that we live in, the nightmare that we as a civilization have placed on ourselves. I think this is a person who is frustrated with that, especially if you're trying to solve a case in a limited amount of time. I don't know. It's just the thought of the time.
When you're doing a line like "Make My Day," and okay, this is a really good line. Do you like go home and do line readings and go "Make My Day," "Make My Day," "Make My Day," and just do it over and over until you figure out exactly how you want to do it?
Looking into the bathroom right. Mirror and doing some of your best acting.
Are you talking to me?
No, I don't. I don't go over the lines. I don't play them out loud. I'd rather play them for the first time when I do them.
No,
and
really?
I usually do them by the motivation of what the feelings are at the time. So I start them from what the intent is, and then let it kind of go out. It's sort of like blowing through a trumpet or something. You start, and the sound magnifies as it comes out. If you sit there and practice line readings to yourself, you'll just get confused.
I want to get to your spaghetti westerns, the films you made with Sergio Leone. You started the Sergio Leone films when you were still making Rawhide, the TV western. How did Sergio Leone get to see Rawhide and decide you were the one to star in his western?
He had seen an episode that somebody had... was showing around, an agency had in Rome, and he had seen an episode, and they thought, well, here's a chance to hire an American actor who has been doing westerns but is not very expensive, and that they didn't have any
right.
They didn't have any money to spend, so they didn't have a lot of choices as far as names of the moment.
There's a lot of really interesting facial close-ups in your movies with Sergio Leone. And he had a very iconographic way of shooting faces, particularly your face. And your face in those close-ups is often, mysterious, unknowable. Instead of the facial close-ups like revealing this essence of who you are, they reveal the unknowability of who you are. And I've always wondered, what were you thinking during those close-ups to get the right expression on your face?
The first response would be to say absolutely nothing. To get the... George Cukor used to say he'd tell Greta Garbo sometimes to look into the camera and stare and don't think about a thing. But that's maybe a little oversimplification or a way to get a certain effect out of her at that time. But you think about what you're doing with the plot line, what the demands are of the plot. Usually, because this character, though he wasn't saying a lot, he was plotting a lot. And so you just thought about what your next moves were. It's just a question of thinking like you would in real life. You don't, you may be thinking, you have an inner monologue. Every actor plays an inner monologue as you're playing your outer character. And sometimes your outer character is saying, good evening, it's wonderful to see you. But underneath you might be saying, yeah, dirty, rotten. So, you know, you really don't... care. And so that's your inner monologue. And so I might have been saying something like that to myself at the time.
You developed a squint also in some of those close-ups.
Well, that was just the sunlight.
Yeah.
They bomb me with a bunch of lights and you're outside and it's 90 degrees. It's hard not to squint.
Now, in Richard Schickel's book about you, he says that, Rawhide followed the strict production code of the time. You couldn't show a fired gun and the victim of the bullet in the same shot. There had to be an edit in between. What was your reaction to Sergio Leone's really vivid approach to violence?
Well, that was true. The Hays office at that time had a rule for Westerns only, ironically, and you couldn't show the shootee and the shooter in the same shot. It couldn't be a tie-up shot, in other words. So you'd have to do it as an individual cut. And if you look at even later American Westerns of High Noon, you won't see the tie-up. But Sergio didn't know about all that, and I wasn't about to tell him because I was really enjoying this. It was breaking all... We were trying to break all the molds. And in breaking all the molds, it made those pictures a hit or as somewhat of a revisionist idea or certainly an outsider's point of view. They became popular, but they also brought with it some resentment. There was a lot of people who felt that... there were a lot of people felt maybe... Who is this upstart? We didn't come in and bless this guy to come along, and we didn't bless these movies to come along, an Italian interpretation of the great American genre. So there was a certain resentment that hung around with those pictures for some time. Now, as people look back on them, they enjoy the fact that there was a different this was a different period, and then it went on to somebody else. And Sam Peckinpah came along later, and he did another look at the Western. And someone else comes along and does another one. And I come back to him and take another shot. And somebody else down the line, that way it keeps a great American art form alive.
Clint Eastwood talking with Terry Gross in 1996. This Sunday, he receives a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to a 1996 interview with Clint Eastwood. His latest movie, Bloodwork, is now out on DVD.
The first Dirty Harry film was very controversial. A lot of people saw it as a cop who was a real law and order, right-wing kind of cop, don't worry about reading somebody their rights. Don't worry about obeying the law. Just make the collar and, you know, get them behind bars. Paul Newman apparently turned down the role for political reasons. What did you see, Clint Eastwood, what did you see in this role when you took it on? What interested you in the character?
I saw an exciting detective story. I saw a script that was concerned about the victims of violent crime rather than the accused, so that was an interesting way to go. There was no big call to drop all the rights of the accused of crime or anything like that. It just happened to be a frustrating situation, all set up by the Harry Julian Fink script of the fact that there was a time element in having to solve the case. There's nothing right-wing about that. There's nothing... they weren't intended to be that way. Don Siegel and myself just saw it as a chance to do an exciting film. If somebody wanted to politicize it, that's fine. There's a couple comments about Miranda and a few decisions like that, but I think there's been in recent years some discussion about that, maybe some of those decisions are not always practical. That's the way it is. I think the blue-collar person out there, the Mr. and Mrs. Middle America who sit there and we're watching the press being constantly concerned with the accused and never once thinking about victims, saw this movie as somewhat of a breath of fresh air. Since that movie and that time, we're in another era now where they have victims' rights organizations and all kinds of attention put upon that. But at that particular time, nobody had the imagination to picture themselves the victim of violent crime.
Clint Eastwood, I thought that your choice of directing and starring in The Unforgiven was such an interesting choice because it's a movie about a man who goes from bad man to good man to myth. And it's also interesting because it's about the difficulty of killing someone and what it takes out of you when you do kill someone. And you'd been in so many mythic movies and been in so many movies where the character that you played killed a lot of people. So I'm interested in how you related to the story in The Unforgiven and how it dealt with myth-making and with violence.
Well, those exact things that you mentioned are what attracted me to the project, the fact that... but even though I had done pictures where I've been a police officer and Western films where I've had a lot of gunplay and stuff, it's not that I approved of that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily approve of the romanticizing of gunplay, and I don't think it's... and I thought here was a chance, here was a story that had... that sort of shot holes in that, if you'll pardon the pun, you know, it brought out the truth about gunplay and the fact that there is some loss to your soul when you commit an act of violence, and to play a person who was deeply affected in his life because of some of the mayhem that he'd been responsible for was to me made the character more interesting. It was more interesting for me to play, in fact, I never thought the film would be really commercial when I was making it, because it had all these statements about mayhem and violence, and I thought maybe this might not be a straight ahead action movie that people wanted, but I liked the story and I felt it was worth telling.
Well, Clint Eastwood, I feel like I must talk with you a little bit about music. And to kick off this chapter of our interview, let's listen to this.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me saddle my old saddle.
And that's from the album Clint Eastwood Sings Cowboy Favorites. And there's a picture of Clint Eastwood as Rowdy Yates on the cover. Rawhide's Clint Eastwood singing.
That was yeah. I was the Milli Vanilli of the moment there. I did. That wasn't me.
Oh yes, it was. I actually like your singing voice. I really do. I mean, this is a strange album with strange arrangements and. Not always good songs, but I really like your singing, and I imagine you're also like influenced by Chet Baker in your singing. And...
Well, that wasn't first place. That wasn't the kind of songs that I would normally like to sing.
The songs on here, I'd imagine not. Yeah. But you got to sing Cole Porter. Don't fence me in.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cole Porter is certainly wonderful. But what happened is that somebody had the brilliant idea that that I should do some cowboy songs, not country western songs. Nashville type, but real straight cowboy songs, and I wasn't sure whether I liked the idea, but they said, "Well, we'll do it, and we have a session tomorrow." And I said, "Well, tomorrow I'm leaving." "Well, will you do it? You just stop by the studio on the way to the airport." So I did a whole album. You think about people who take 6 months to make an album, but this one, that we did the whole album in one session, and I didn't know the songs. I had to come in and learn them real quick. And some of them I knew, some songs like that you've heard as a child, but you don't really know them. And so it was a little frustrating. It wasn't my favorite musical experience in life, but it was, there again, you learn something every day.
Now, had you sung much before? Did you think of yourself as a singer at all?
Not really. I'd done a few things. I'd done a few records. I'd been involved in music, so I could sometimes carry a tune. My father loved singing. He had a group that played, and he loved to sing all the time. He would love to have been a singer more than anything, I think.
No, I know you're still, and were as a young man, very passionate about jazz. Did you ever think that you'd become a professional musician instead of an actor and director?
Well, I thought about that earlier when I was a kid and I was doing things, but I never thought, I never really knew what I wanted to do until I became an actor. And at that point, I kind of knew which direction I was going to at least get up and swing at bat.
Would you like to sing more or play more? Or?
No, I don't have any there's one of my key sayings.
Yes.
A man must know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood from a 1996 interview with Terry Gross. This Sunday, the Screen Actors Guild honors him with a Lifetime Achievement Award. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Englishman's Daughter, a true story of love and betrayal in World War I by Ben McIntyre. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, cool spy gadgets, special effects, and empowered kids. An interview with filmmaker Robert Rodriguez. His movie Spy Kids 2 is now out on video. Also, David Edelstein reviews Tears of the Sun, the latest Bruce Willis action film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Robert Rodriguez made his name as a filmmaker with a string of movies so violent that one of them was banned by censors in Ireland. Who could have predicted that the man behind the action pictures El Mariachi, Desperado, and the mock horror films From Dusk Till Dawn and The Faculty would be where he is now, the writer, director, and producer of the gentle, imaginative Spy Kids movies? But Rodriguez's career doesn't follow any of the usual Hollywood rules. He financed his first film, El Mariachi, with $7,000, mainly earned by hiring himself out as a subject for medical experiments, and he made the Spy Kids movies from his home studio in Austin, Texas. I spoke with Rodriguez last summer about his latest film, the sequel, Spy Kids 2, which has just come out on DVD. In the Spy Kids films, the spy kids discover that their square parents are really ultra-hip secret agents. The kids then become small super spies themselves. In this scene from Spy Kids 2, they're being briefed on their new spy gadgets by Machete, their uncle, played by Danny Trejo.
I brought you all new gadgets.
Check it out, the very latest spy watch. Cell phone, internet access, satellite TV, you name it. That baby will do everything but tell you what time it is.
It doesn't tell time?
There was no more room for the clock.
Are you sure these are new? We can't be running around with outdated equipment.
I'm gonna give you the one gadget you should always carry.
A rubber band?
It's a Machete Elastic Wonder.
It's a rubber band.
Yeah, but it's also the world's greatest gadget. 999 uses.
Use number one, a stylish bracelet. Use number two. Ah!
Robert Rodriguez, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's great to be back after, I think, 10 years.
You know, Spy Kids, too, has the greatest gadgets in it. There's a little personal robot that looks like a cootie bug and a huge magnetic aircraft which sucks up bad guys. And I like that all-purpose silver ponytail holder. And it seemed to be kind of a metaphor for your approach to a somewhat big-budget film with a lot of special effects that, in the end, nothing beats the simplest solutions.
The simplest solutions and just sort of the low-tech in a high-tech world solutions, you know, always having to be resourceful. And creativity and imagination is always more important than technology and technique. I wanted to use those two metaphors, and really your methodology ends up becoming part of the thematic material. I really like using lower budgets, and instead of having money to solve creative problems on the set, you just use your creativity. And that's what makes the movie so much more creative and more fun. And it was really essential for a movie like Spy Kids to feel more creative, like a finger painting, than just big and expensive, like a big movie usually does.
Now, that must have also contributed to the plot line that the spy kids land on an island where no gadgets work. Even though they have the newest and the latest and the best gadgets of all, they have to end up using their heads to solve the case. And it impressed me as a comment on kids and gear and labels and how technology dependent kids are.
Yes, adults as well, but yeah, especially kids. My children, as young as they are, I have a little boy who's under the age of 6, and they're so technologically savvy. And I live a little ways out of Austin to where even if a small storm comes by, all our power goes out for at least a day. And it always shocks all of us how technologically dependent we are. So I really wanted to play with the idea of loading the kids up with all the latest, coolest gadgets and then stripping that away from them midway through the movie where they have to go on a mission where they have to use their heads and they've already forgotten how to do that. They don't even know how to tie their shoes anymore because it used to be automatic.
Well, there are a ton of visual effects in this movie. In both the Spy Kids movies. How does that compare to other big budget movies like this, say Inspector Gadget or some of the others?
I don't know how many are in that, but our movies cost a fraction of the cost of, say, like a Stuart Little, which I don't really know the true budget, but what I've heard is it's like $120 million. This one costs $38 because I make it at home. I do a lot of the jobs myself. Our crew was all that way also. And we just use creativity instead of, I get to make my own budgets. And the studio always wants to give me more. It's always the reverse. The studio says, are you sure you don't want more money? We'll give you $60 million. The money's not going to make it good. The money's not going to make it better or more creative. And the more you're limited by money and by resources, the more you're forced to be more creative. So I don't know if you've seen the movie, but one of the favorite scenes is when two kids walk into a room where they can't hear each other talk, but they can hear each other think. And the audience, you hear the audience, they're so surprised by the idea and they laugh. That idea cost $5 because it doesn't require anything but the idea. And when you don't have the money, you're forced to come up with things that, you know, instead of thinking, how am I going to spend $100 million today? You think, how am I going to make this movie good and interesting and fun for people? And your thinking goes to a different area, and it's so fun to try to, you know, solve these challenges creatively.
So do you just sit at your computer and think up some of these creative solutions, or do you do something or go somewhere to get your head in that right place to take you back to that kind of kid wacky creativity?
This is the trick. I turned into Night Guy because I found, you know, and this happens to everybody, the way the workday works, it's really anti-family because you're really just starting to get cooking at your job, whatever it is, near the end of the day. And if you stay late at work, wow, the kids are already asleep and they've already had dinner and you've missed it. I switched my schedule around completely and it works so much better. If you can be a night person, you should try this. It's really fun. What I do is I make breakfast for the kids because I love to cook. They go to school, I go to sleep. I wake up, I go pick them up from school, we play for a little while, maybe we'll go swimming, I'll work a little bit in the garage. I do everything at home, the editing, the sound mix, everything I do in my garage. And then I'll cook dinner for them, they go to sleep, and then while they're asleep, I work all night. And because I'm working all night, no one calls because everyone else is gone from the office. So you have so much time to just concentrate on the work you're doing and be creative, and you're really more creative at night. I think that's why musicians and other artists are night people. Because the world goes to sleep and your mind is also in a semi-dream state. And you really can come up with things that you wouldn't normally think of while you're being distracted during the day. And one full night of work equals at least 5 working regular days. And you get so much done in a short amount of time. That's the trick.
The screen technically jumps out at you in Spy Kids, in Spy Kids 2 especially. It really pops. And I know that you're using this new technology, high-definition digital cameras, to film the movie. They were customized for the shoot. How so?
Well, these cameras are so incredible. You can go customize them yourself and give it their own look. And you have to say something real quick because people get confused. It's such a new medium that everything is called digital, whether it's mini DV that you shoot at home or high def. And there's a big difference. It's almost like there's so many different types of film. There's Super 8, there's 16, there's 35, there's 70 millimeter. The video you have at home, the little mini DV, that's kind of like Super 8. This HD is more like 70 millimeter. I mean, it looks amazing. It looks better than traditional film. It's much more colorful. It feels a lot more like the old Technicolor movies I grew up watching. And I really wanted that back. I was really disappointed how Spy Kids looked on film because I was there on the sets, and the sets were so vibrant and so colorful, but it doesn't translate to film. Film isn't as good as it used to be, and it just keeps getting worse because of just the technology itself. But George Lucas turned me on to these high-def cameras. And he's always 10, 20 years ahead of everybody. So I thought, he's Obi-Wan. I'm following him. I'm not going to wait 10 years to figure this out. I'm going to go buy 2 cameras, hot rod them, you know, figure out how to give them a really neat look and go shoot with them. And it's just a revelation. I mean, you can shoot so quickly. You can be so creative. And then the finished image looks like what it was on the set. Very vibrant colors. Especially I like to use a lot of Latin colors. Very childlike colors. Very, very poppy. And it's the look I was going for.
How does the technology, the high-def technology, change the actual way you go about shooting the scenes?
Amazingly, and we're just because we've gotten used to it, you don't realize how much you'll dislike film until something better comes along. When you're shooting a movie, you're literally shooting blind, and because you don't see what you did till the next day when you get dailies back, when you get to actually see the film. Because you're on the set, you have a really bad monitor, you can't judge color, lighting, performance at all. And you wait till it's almost like being a painter painting in the dark, and you have to wait till the next day to see, I wonder if I used the right color. I wonder if I even hit the canvas. And with high definition, you're seeing the best picture on the set. What you're going to see at the premiere is actually already on the set while you're doing it. And that's not a luxury. It's actually a revelation because when you're shooting a film, you never really feel like you're getting what you want. Ask any director, they'll tell you the finished movie is 40 to 60% of the vision they had. Well, because they were shooting blind. Now, I call this movie making with the lights on. You can really see what you're doing. You know when you got a performance. You know when you got it right. You know when you've put the flag in the day's work. And it changes your attitude completely. Instead of leaving the day wondering, did I even get it? Was I even close? Now you leave. Every day's Christmas on the set because the actors come over and they look at the monitor and they go, oh, my God, we nailed that. Or we can do even much better than that. Let's make this or let's try that. And it elevates the art form in a way that when you see Spy Kids 2, it came out much better than it has any right to be for being a number 2 because we were seeing what we were doing as we were doing it and we really felt we were making the best movie possible.
Director Robert Rodriguez, his latest film, Spy Kids 2, is out on video and DVD. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air.
Back now to our interview with director Robert Rodriguez. His films include El Mariachi, Desperado, and the Spy Kids movies. Now, when you made your first film, El Mariachi, you made it on this really nothing budget, $7,000,
right.
and half of it was money you made by hiring yourself out for medical research.
Yeah. I was from a family of 10. I couldn't go borrow money from them. I had to sell my body to science. It was just such a... And people kept saying, wow, $7,000, that's so cheap. It's cheap. When you're from a family of 10, that's like all the money in the world. You know, I had to be so careful. All the money just went to buying film. Film was so expensive. That's what I really love about digital. Is that you could literally, I could really go make that same movie now for $5.
But was there a weird period early then in your career after El Mariachi was such a hit and attracted attention of Columbia and other Hollywood studios and they started to woo you? Did they just throw money at you for hotels and restaurants and expense accounts in Hollywood?
It's not that they throw money. That's just really the business has built itself into. Not from Texas. So it was very strange. I was very broke. But they, you know, part of the budgets that they have, and that's why studios have a lot of overhead, is when you bring someone who's considered a talent up, you, they put you in a real nice hotel. They you know, you get what's called a per diem, which is a daily expense account. And I was so poor, and from a family of 10, I was thinking, wow, this is a really great hotel I'm staying in. Could I just have the money instead that you're paying, and I'll go check into a smaller hotel. In fact, I'll go sleep in my office because it's really a nice office. It's got a shower and everything. So they said, well, no one's ever asked that before. So they gave me the money that they would normally spend on a nice hotel. They just let me take it as a per diem check, and I put that away, and I was able to put my brother through school and buy a new car, and I just slept in my office for a year. When you come from a family of 10, the survival instinct never goes away. But, you know, in Hollywood, they don't think anything twice of that. It's like, oh, yeah, you're coming. Oh, we'll fly you up first class. We'll put you in a nice hotel. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really need any of that. It's really all about the work, you know.
Now, the critics called El Mariachi a quasi-spaghetti Western. And Desperado was a kind of English-language version of El Mariachi. And you're filming now, or you're finishing now, the third in this series of Westerns. It's due out next year. And you also made a horror comedy written by and starring Quentin Tarantino called From Dusk Till Dawn. What's the connection between these shoot 'em up films and blood and gore and sweet, you know, G-rated spy kids family films? And the only thing that's obvious to me is that they're all funny and they're all fantasies.
They're all funny and comedic. Yeah, they're all fantasies. I'm in a fantasy filmmaking. What happened was before Mariachi came out, all I did was family comedies because, again, I was from such a big family. I would be at home when I was 12 making these little action movies. And all I had around me were my little brothers and sisters to star in them. So I made them the action stars. And they would always win contests. So I thought, wow, that's kind of a winning combination. Have kids that are really younger than you would expect doing action and comedy. And audiences of all ages loved it. So I really thought that would be my big movie. And when I had to make my first film for the Spanish video market, they only wanted an action film. So I made El Mariachi. But even that I couldn't take very seriously. So I made him a guitar player who becomes a hitman. And then Columbia wanted an action movie. So I said, well, let's do Desperado, which, again, is still kind of comical. And if you look at it, it's very fantastical. It's a made-up Mexico. It's guys shooting missiles out of their guitar cases. It really makes very little sense. But I had a good time as a cartoonist making it. And then when they offered me From Dusk Till Dawn, that's even a bigger cartoon of a movie. Very comical. Again, a lot of gadgets and a lot of just imagination overdrive in what's supposed to be a horror movie. You know, I knew every day, I got to do something horrific because that's the audience, but I couldn't help but be very kind of cartoony about it. And I was really just getting experience to do my Spy Kids movie because I knew that was going to be the big one. I was really just learning effects, learning how to make a movie myself in that arena so that I could make it a very personalized movie like I had done with Mariachi. Really stripped down the process so that I would be free to create whatever I wanted. And I was really just building up to do Spy Kids.
Well, you know, I couldn't sleep one night and I turned on the TV at about 2 a.m. And next thing I know, I'm seeing these half-naked screaming vampire women attacking bikers. And there's green goo flying everywhere. And there's buckets of blood and people are hitting each other with lopped-off body parts.
And I'm thinking, who left the TV on the X-rated sci-fi channel? And then I realize, wow, isn't that George Clooney? And there's Juliette Lewis. And there's Harvey Keitel is in this movie. Good God, this is supposed to be a real movie.
It's so funny. Quentin's biggest thrill was the fact that he was hoping someone would watch it exactly the way you did. You know, his only regret was that they give that away when the movie comes out, that it's two movies in one. But he said the way someone should see it is they should just be watching it on cable, watching this very Desperate Hours type serious, you know, movie. And then suddenly you turn the page and it's this wacky vampire film. And you're wondering, what did I just drink? What happened? What's going on? And it was actually George Clooney's first movie. He was still on ER at that time. And I really thought he could be a big star. And I gave him his first, you know, big break.
So when you make that kind of horror gore fest, do things get out of hand? Does someone on the crew say, look, I can make blood spurt 20 feet or eyeballs pop out 20 feet? So you just let them?
It's kind of a fun job in a way. It's really harder to make a movie like that than something that I'm more inclined to do, like a Spy Kids type movie. You still have to be creative. I mean, I'd walk on the set and, you know, I'm not a morning guy and you always have to shoot in the morning. So I got on the set and I'm thinking, okay, here we go. We're going to do another day. What are we doing today? Oh, well, at this point in the script, it says we have to pull Tom Savini's head off and kick it around the room. Oh, okay. Well, that sounds like fun. Let's do that. And it is kind of creative and fun in a different way because, you know, it's for a very limited audience. It's for the horror audience. So you gotta kind of come up with, how am I going to make a horror movie when I'm not a horror guy? And so it is a challenge. It is. I'm much more comfortable making these Spy Kid movies. And what's funny is just because the other movies came out first, you think it's odd that I'm making a family film when really everyone in my family thought it was odd I was making those other films. So it was completely backwards. And if you actually go back and watch Dusk Till Dawn and Desperado, you really see the Spy Kids in all those movies.
Well, we have a clip from Dusk Till Dawn. And in this scene, George Clooney he plays this biker criminal who's dragged some hostages, played by Juliette Lewis and Harvey Keitel, to a biker bar, which turns out to be a haven for creatures of the undead. And Clooney and everyone else are all just now coming to grips with this strange turn of events.
Does anybody know what's going on here?
I know what's going on. We got a bunch of vampires out there trying to get in here and suck our blood. And that's it, plain and simple. And I don't want to hear anything about I don't believe in vampires, because I don't believe in vampires. What I believe in my own two eyes and what I saw is vampires. Now, do we all agree that what we are dealing with is vampires?
Yes.
You too, preacher?
I don't believe in vampires, but I believe in what I saw.
Good for you. All right, now that we all agree that we're dealing with vampires, what do we know about vampires? Crosses hurt vampires. Do we have a cross?
In the motorhome.
In other words, no.
Wait a second. I mean, just look around. We got crosses all over the place. All you gotta do is put two sticks together. You got a cross.
Yeah, he's right. Peter Cushing does that all the time.
Okay, I'll buy that. So we got crosses covered. What else?
Wooden stakes in the heart. Been working pretty good so far. And garlic. Sunlight. Holy water. I'm not sure. Doesn't silver have something to do with vampires?
That's werewolves.
I know silver bullets are werewolves, but I'm sure silver has something to do with vampires.
Well, does anybody have any silver? Okay, then who cares?
Has anybody here read a real book about vampires, or are we just remembering what some movie said? I mean, a real book.
You mean like a Time Life book?
I take it the answer is no.
A clip from, I guess, Robert Rodriguez's 1996 mock horror road movie From Dusk Till Dawn. So how did you even get away with making a movie that was literally two movies in one? First, this very serious, dark, Pulp Fiction-like road movie, which turns into a vampire fest.
This is the great thing about Hollywood, is that nobody wanted to make this movie. Quentin had written, this is one of the first scripts Quentin wrote. And everyone said, oh my God, it's two movies in one. It makes absolutely no sense. You'll never get this movie made. And then he made Pulp Fiction. And suddenly everyone wanted to make this movie. There was a huge bidding war for it because they go, oh my God, it's great. It's two movies in one. It's suddenly what its disadvantage became its advantage. And it gave us creative freedom to do whatever we wanted, because Quentin and I both, we make movies very inexpensively. And that's the trick. If you're getting a chance to make your movie, it would make almost sense to try to get as much money as you can from a studio to make the best movie, right? Wrong. The more money you get, the more they're all over you, questioning your every decision. You're almost like become the painter who keeps getting the paintbrush pulled out of his hand, and they say, use red, not yellow. And you're like, why? I don't know, because you're spending so much money, we want to make sure you do it right, and then it becomes wrong. So our trick has always been, use very little money, be very creative, and then you have the creative freedom to do whatever you want. So that's why I've always kept my budgets lower, so I can make a family film without having to have people question your move. And the studios support that, because if you make the movie inexpensively, no matter what, it'll be profitable. Dusk Till Dawn was very profitable because it cost us $10 million. And but we had the freedom to just do something that could become a cult movie.
Robert Rodriguez recorded last summer. His latest film, Spy Kids 2, is out on video and DVD. Coming up, a review of the new Bruce Willis film. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Willis stars in the new film Tears of the Sun, directed by Antoine Fuqua, who made Training Day. Willis plays the leader of a Navy SEALs unit on a rescue mission in Nigeria. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
There's a sequence in the new Bruce Willis war picture, Tears of the Sun, that split me down the middle. I wanted to cheer my head off, and I wanted to throw things at the screen. Willis plays Navy SEAL Lieutenant A.K. Waters, who leads an elite squadron into the Nigerian countryside after a fictional coup by a military dictator. His task is to retrieve a Doctors Without Borders physician, played by Monica Bellucci, from a Catholic mission in a remote village. But the doctor won't leave without the villagers she's caring for. She wants Waters to get them to Cameroon, which is against the lieutenant's orders. And this lieutenant is an orders machine. So here's the scene that tore me apart. The Navy SEALs and the 50 or so Nigerians are moving through the jungle, and they pass a village where guerrillas are raping, torturing, and murdering men, women, and children. One of Waters' men reports they have a, quote, ringside seat to an ethnic cleansing. But can they walk away from these blood-freezing cries? Down the embankment, a guerrilla pours gasoline over a man on his knees, then takes a lighter out of his pocket and holds it aloft. Waters turns to his team's ace sniper, who's already in position, and says, "Zippo first." And the sniper says, "Yeah." And after a nearly unendurable few beats, Zippo takes two or three in the chest. The SEALs are too late to save most of the villagers, but when one American soldier pulls a gorilla off a horribly mutilated woman with a dead baby, he forces the killer to regard his handiwork. Then he guts him. My own gut reaction is easily stated. Onward, Christian soldiers. Cleanse those ethnic cleansers. Here's Willis as Lieutenant Waters taking a poll of his men. He wants to know what they think of his unprecedented show of humanitarian disobedience.
It's been strongly suggested that we turn over Arthur and abandon these refugees out here in the bush. I'll tell you right now, I'm not going to do that. Can't do that. Broke my own rule. I brought you guys along with me. I have to hear what you guys have to say about it. That's all. Speak freely.
Let's get these people to safety. Let's finish the job.
What about you, Rick?
I'm gonna get them out. I'm going to die trying.
Willis underplays manfully. His great bald head is used like an eagle's as an emblem of toughness and liberty. At the end of the scene you've just heard, he makes an amazing declaration. He says he's saving the villagers for all the years we've been told to stand down or stand by for our sins. On one hand, Tears of the Sun is an inspiring story of American valor and self-sacrifice. On the other, it seems so far removed from the real world that it amounts to a sort of opium dream of heroism, a collective fantasy to make us feel better about ourselves on the eve of a controversial military action. This is how we'd like Americans to be seen, as great soldiers and great moral individualists, policing the planet, protecting the helpless. But has any American platoon ever moved in to stop an ethnic cleansing? Even UN troops have a spotty record in Africa and the Balkans when it comes to engaging the enemy. This vision of a sensitive, humanistic, morally engaged American military is very appealing. But it might not be grounded in anything but Hollywood corn and national hubris. Tears of the Sun is directed by Antoine Fuqua, the music video hotshot who did Training Day, and he's a smart filmmaker. There are no fussy effects in the battle scenes, just good, scary quiet before the storm, then fast and fluid action. Yet it doesn't cut very deep. It doesn't have the acid ironies or the dizzying lack of gravity that David O. Russell brought to Three Kings, another brutal war movie about amoral soldiers moved to do the right thing. Tears of the Sun opens with actual footage of a civilian being shot by a Nigerian army officer at close range. And it strikes me as obscene to use a real-life atrocity as a prelude to a Hollywood fantasy starring this year's international sex goddess, Monica Bellucci. Don't misunderstand. Bellucci is a brave and surprisingly down-to-earth actress. But when the Navy shows Waters and his squad her picture, and she has huge dark eyes and puffy covergirl lips, and they don't explode in whoops, you know you're in Never Never Land, a place where warriors are gentlemen and African peasants give thanks in song to their great American saviors.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, bringing Sergeant Joe Friday into the 21st century, we talk with Waylon Greene, one of the executive producers of the new Dragnet. He also worked on Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue, ER, and Law and Order. Join us for the next Fresh Air.